They Walk Among Us is a podcast exploring the UK's most sinister and surreal crimes, including the woman who killed the boyfriend as he spent too much time on Facebook, to the teenage boys whose online relationship involves spies, sex, and the near-fatal stabbing of one of them. Subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast provider.
Hello, my name is Cassandra, and I was incarcerated for 14 years for a crime that I did not commit.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast dedicated to spreading awareness of wrongful conviction. Today, we're going to hear the story of Cassandra Rivera, who was part of a group of women known as the San Antonio Four, who spent nearly 14 years in prison for a crime they did not commit. I also want to remind you to check out our other podcast, Convicted. It's a long-form show about a man who's incarcerated for the murder of his 2-year-old daughter. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode is being brought to you by Smile Direct Club, an amazing sponsor that I cannot recommend enough. The people at Smile Direct Club believe you shouldn't have to pay a fortune to get a smile you'll love. They straighten and brighten most smiles for 70% less than the other aligners or braces. And they work directly with state-certified dentists and orthodontists to ship custom invisible aligners straight to your door in convenient monthly shipments. This means no more expensive in-office visits, no more embarrassing wires or brackets, and no more wasting money. Smile Direct Club aligners are already affordable. They're 70% less than other brands or braces, but you could save even more with insurance or an FSA. Many dental insurance plans reimburse customers for a portion of the cost of invisible aligners. And Smile Direct Club accepts FSAs. There's two easy ways to pay. Single pay is a single payment of $1,700, and the lab costs are waived. Other invisible aligner brands can cost up to $5,000 on average. Or take advantage of Smile Pay. It's only $250 down and $99 a month for 17 months, a total of $1,933, and no credit check is required. You can get started with an at-home impression kit for only $95. It's covered by our Smile Guarantee, so if our aligners aren't a good fit for you, you get your money back. With this special offer, you can save 50% on this evaluation cost. Board certified, state licensed dentists and orthodontists within the Smile Direct Club network are involved throughout the entire process to assess and prescribe remote treatment. I just started my own journey with Smile Direct Club, and it was super easy, and it took less than 30 minutes. I was sent an impression kit that included the easy instructions with pictures, items I needed to make the impressions, and a return label, all in the same box. I was a little nervous at first because I'd never done anything like this before, but the impressions turned out perfect and I can't wait until the next step. You can save 50% off the cost of Smile Direct Club's at-home impression kit by visiting smiledirectclub.com and using the promo code ACTUAL at checkout. It's unavailable in North Carolina. So visit smiledirectclub.com and use the promo code ACTUAL today. If you, your children, ages 12 and up, or anyone you know is interested in straightening their smile. I met Cassandra at the Innocence Network conference, and she is a genuinely nice person. I'm so glad she agreed to share her story. Not only was she incarcerated for 15 years for a crime she didn't commit, but her children lost those years with their mother. This is Cassandra's story.
I grew up with a brother, and we were very, very, very close. Of course, I had my mom and my dad. We moved from time to time because my father worked with Southwestern Bell, and he constantly had to relocate. We lived the longest probably in Devine, Texas, which is out in the country, and it was beautiful. We had a fishing tank where we'd go fishing. They would go hunting on our property. We had cows, we had chickens, we had ducks, even a turkey. So we had a pretty good bringing up. In 1994, I was living life. I had just met my new partner, Anna Vasquez, we started a relationship. It was all new to us because, of course, you know, I had never been in a gay or lesbian relationship. So meeting her was something totally different for me, and we were very happy. And we were only about 19 at the time, and I had my two children, so we began a life together. We were raising them. We were working, and I wanted to go to school. I was working at AutoZone, and all of a sudden, these charges hit us at a very, very, it was just tragic. We didn't even understand why, but when the charges came about, it was like a serious nightmare began, and we ended up having to, you know, get representation. Our lives just went into a whirlwind. We couldn't believe it, and our families were hurt. You know, of course, I had my son and daughter who were 7 and 8 years old, and yeah, that was really, really, really extremely hard. Being that I had them and I had to fight for my freedom, you know, to prove that I was innocent, not knowing why or what, you know, the motive or the cause of the accusations were. But it was a very difficult time for us.
Can you tell me about the accusations?
Yes. So when we were informed of the accusations, we were contacted by a detective, Majeka. This gentleman came to us, who, mind you, this is supposed to be a child case because we were accused of indecency with a child and of a sexual aggravated assault of a child. So when he came to us as a homicide detective, we did not know what to think. Of course, we're young and we're naive, so we just felt that everything was fine and we had nothing to hide, nothing to, you know, to keep from him. So we went ahead and volunteered all our information because we felt, you know, the truth set you free. We didn't do anything wrong. There's no reason why we should be afraid to talk to this man. And we gave our statements to him. But when we found out the accusations, I mean, like I said, I have a son and a daughter, and I would never dream of hurting a child. And it was horrible. So this homicide detective questions us, we give him our statements, and he's telling us that within 6 months, you know, if we don't hear from him, if he doesn't contact us, then we're free to continue our lives. Well, it didn't work out that way. 6 months later, we were indicted. I was at my place where I worked. I was at work that day, and these officers come in an unmarked car, and they pick me up. So from there, we went and we picked up Anna. And then we went and picked up Liz, and they took us downtown.
Can I ask, what happened to your children during that time after you got picked up?
Throughout this, I'm being charged of sexual molestation on children. Throughout this whole process, we were accused in 94. We actually were not incarcerated until 2000. My children were never taken away from me. CPS never got involved. By the grace of God, you know, I got to keep my kids before I actually had to turn myself in. So my mom and my brother, God, they are amazing. They took care of them while I was going through this. And while I had to serve, and while I had to serve 14 years, she brought them up to the best of her ability. And they're amazing. They're doing good today.
So I'm sorry, I interrupted your story.
Yes, they picked up just me, Anna, and Liz that day. And they took us downtown where we were indicted. And while we were there, we were actually taken to protective custody, and eventually our families put up a bond for us to get us out.
What were your interactions with the police like? Like, what kind of things did they say?
Well, you know, we were scared and we were worried because these are the most horrible crimes that anybody can be accused of. You know, when somebody comes to you and tell you that a child has been molested, the first thing you think about is, God, what a monster, what a horrible person. And I can't believe that this person did that. I mean, I have two children. I couldn't even tell you how I'd act if I found out somebody had hurt my children. So knowing that, we were scared, we didn't know what people were going to say about us. And our case was completely highly publicized. It was very, very highly publicized. So when we were actually taken in and indicted, we had some, of course, that, you know, treated us a little differently, that looked at us up and down. And I'm sure they were, you know, wondering in the back of their minds, you know, you know, if we had really done it or not, because a lot of them knew that we were fighting, you know, obviously, but it was just horrible.
Did they ever at any time, like when they were questioning you, offer you an attorney or offer you any kind of support?
Okay, so with Detective Majeka, when I say that we spoke to him freely, at first we did tell him that we wanted an attorney present. I have a family member that is an attorney, and when we first found out about the charges, he informed my father that I needed to have a lawyer present if I gave any type of statement. So with that being said, I was trying to do that, but this detective ended up showing up at my house, and he told me that he was going to take my kids away if I didn't tell him anything. And like I said, I had nothing to hide. So instead of having an attorney with me, I felt, look, I'm just going to talk to him, because I did not want to lose my kids. And I was like, there's no reason why I need an attorney, because I didn't do anything. So I might as well go on and give this statement. And that's where we pretty much messed up.
So you said that you went to the indictment, and I'm going to make a confession. I don't know exactly how that works. What happens at an indictment?
Okay, when we're indicted, there was no confession. But what happened was, when they picked us up, that was when it was sentenced down. They indicted us. They booked us. They, you know, when they fingerprint you, they take you in and they throw you in a cell, and you know that you're there for this crime. So yeah, that's what happened that day. And from then on, like I said, we were there for about 30 days until their families were able to bond us out.
How long between that did you have to wait for the trial?
Okay, that was actually in 1994. Elizabeth went to trial in 1997. I went to trial in 98 with Anna and Christy.
You were tried at the same time as two other people.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, we were separate from Elizabeth.
And did you all have separate counsel, or was there like one attorney representing all three of you?
Well, I will tell you this. When we first were informed of the charges, we, of course, hired representation. And the lawyers that we had wanted us to take a plea bargain. Since Liz went separately, she had another attorney. And when she received 37 and a half years for this crime, they just automatically assumed that there was no point in fighting and that we might as well just, you know, take a deal and go to prison, you know, and try to get out as soon as possible, or take 10 years deferred adjudication and not do any time. But we would have still had a register, which is something they did not tell us. But what we were, you know, set in is, we are not going to take a plea bargain. We committed no crime. There's no reason for us to, even though Elizabeth had received 37 and a half years, there was no reason why we should take a plea bargain when no crime actually occurred. We were going to fight. So we did. We fought.
Good for you.
Yeah, we ended up firing the first attorneys that we had because they were, you know, they just wanted us to take that plea, and they didn't want to do anything for us, and we could see that, so we let them go. So we hired new attorneys, and those attorneys, they did what they could, I guess, was for Latinas that didn't have any type of money, you know, or anything to give them for doing anything more than what they did, and we ended up receiving 15 years.
What, did they have some kind of strategy? Like, what was their defense for you?
No, ma'am. There was no strategy. All they said was, it was not the burden of ours to prove our innocence. It was the burden of them to prove our guilt.
How long did the trial last?
The trial lasted a week.
What did it feel like to, like, I can't imagine, you know, not having done this and being accused of this horrendous thing, like how it felt sitting there listening to the trial go on. I just wondered how it felt.
It was very hard to sit there knowing that these little girls are on the stand telling these stories. And we know that they're fabricating this, that they're lying. And there's also the advocate of the little girls sitting in the courtroom, the one that's supposed to make them feel good. And every time a question is asked to them, this woman is either nodding her head yes or no, like as if she's telling them what to say. And our attorneys had even brought that to the judge's attention. But the judge said that he did not care as long as the kids were comfortable. So, you know, it was so clear that this was just a big plot, or it was just a scheme to hurt us, or it wasn't real. And we believed in the system. We believed that somewhere somebody was going to see something, you know, that it couldn't have possibly occurred, but it never happened that way.
Right. And I think I read that there was some, I'm using air quotes that you can't see, evidence, but it wasn't real evidence.
Exactly.
They did a physical check on one of the girls and they said that she could have hurt herself somehow, but there was no way to know.
Exactly. Exactly. Basically, everything that they went on was hearsay. Now, the medical examiner, Nancy Kellogg, testified that there was such trauma to the victims to where it looked like they had been, you know, sexually abused. But I'm not sure if you're aware all these, I mean, if you're aware, but all these years later, they're saying that, or she is actually saying that she would have never testified to that if she knew now what she knew then, because there was no trauma, you know, indicated in these reports.
How does that feel now, knowing that, I mean, all of these years later, that she admitted that she was, I mean, more or less wrong?
Wow. It's like I think it's like getting slapped in the face twice. The first time you sit there and you lie to me, and then this time you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. There was no trauma. I'm sorry you had to do all this time because of a testimony that I gave, you know, but hey, good luck with your life. You know, it's hard to comprehend that somebody of her stature can just get away with something and not, you know, it goes so unrealized, because we don't know how many other people she's done this to. How many other people's lives have you ruined? You know, ours was brought up because by the grace of God, some people researched our case and saw that there was a mistake in it. But there could be other people sitting in prison right now, and they don't know that she might have actually made that same mistake in their case, you know, and it's so hard to believe that stuff like this happens and that people can just go on with their lives with it.
I feel angry for you. Like right now, I wish you could see my face, because like I feel angry for you that this happened. I am so sorry.
Thank you. It's okay.
How long did the jury deliberate?
Oh, wow. Let's see. So it was a Friday night when we were waiting for the verdict. Our attorneys believed that we were going to win because they felt that they didn't have a strong enough case against us. So what ended up happening is our jury was sequestered, and they ended up putting them up at a hotel nearby. The next day was February 14th, which was Valentine's Day. I guess everybody wanted to go home to their family, so they just decided they didn't want to be sequestered anymore, went to the courthouse on a Saturday, and they convicted us. They found us guilty on Valentine's Day.
How did that feel?
It was horrible. It was horrible. Just knowing that I wasn't going to see my kids again, just knowing that that was it, that, you know, we had fought, we believed that everything was going to be okay, and just hearing them say guilty was, God, it was like the worst feeling ever. And just knowing that I wasn't going to go home to my kids that night, I wasn't going to be able to go home to my mom, you know, was a horrible feeling. What happened was we were convicted and taken back, and then they gave us our sentencing on Monday that next week.
And what was your sentence?
15 years. I ended up at Lane Murray in Gatesville, Texas.
What was it like?
Prison is a nightmare. You are incarcerated with so many different types of people. You see things that you think you're only going to see in the movies. You see fights, you see cuttings, you see people acting out. You see guards fighting with inmates. You see so many different things that you just, as an innocent person, and you're out here living life the way you're supposed to be, to walk into that is like walking into another world and having to build yourself up to just be somebody that you weren't once before, just to survive. And it's horrible.
I've noticed, and even when I met you at the conference, that you have a very like nice aura. I don't know how to put it. Like, you're a very nice person, and you come across as nice and put together. So I wonder, What kind of coping skills did you use to keep that, that nice person that you are while you were incarcerated?
Well, when I was first incarcerated, I was very upset. I was angry. I was hurt. I had just left my two children. And that was the worst thing that a mother can do, is have to walk away when you don't want to walk away. You know, there's no reason why you should have walked away or been taken away. And I had to accept that. And it wasn't something that I wanted to accept. My father had just passed away in 95. My mom was left, like I said, with my brother to raise my two babies. They were only 8 and 9. And when I hit prison, I was upset. I acted out. I wasn't myself. And I might have acted in a way that was completely wrong at first, the first couple of years. But then finally, I got myself together, and I started taking college courses. At first, I had stopped believing in God. I was angry, and I got over that. I started praying again, and like I said, I started my education up, and I just began to better myself.
Good for you.
And my family came to visit me. You know, my family's amazing. My mother's amazing. She would bring my kids to see me as often as possible. And that is what helped me so much, because there's nothing like being in a world where you're alone, you know, not knowing anybody or who you can trust. And it's scary. So when you have those letters to read every night to keep you occupied, and you have those visits to look forward to, and you just know that you're loved and that you're believed in on the outside from the people that you love the most, it helps a lot.
That's amazing. I have been to a prison. I visited an inmate just a couple of months ago. And while I was there, it was completely no contact. Like there wasn't even a way, like if I wanted to like touch him, I could have, because of like the way the glass was. How were your visits with your children? Were you able to like hug them or?
Unfortunately, no, I was not able to touch my babies. And that was really hard, because they would come and see me and have to sit down behind glass, and I would have to watch them grow up that way. That's exactly how I watched them grow up. It's like one visit, my son comes in and he's talking like he still sounds like a little baby. And then the next he comes and all of a sudden his voice has gotten deeper and he's getting facial hair. And my daughter is just so beautiful and, you know, growing. And I'm like, wow, this is what I have to do, you know. And that was really hard. And, you know, I know it was hard for them too, because they always wanted, you know, a hug or something. I mean, because there's nothing more, you know, there's nothing that matters more than to be able to hold your children, you know. So
we're talking right now. Can you tell me, what were the steps to you being released?
Okay, that is an amazing story, because you know, for a long time when we first were incarcerated, and when I finally started, when I got my head on straight, and, you know, I started to believe again, and we all started writing letters. I started writing letters to different organizations, not knowing that the other girls were doing it at the same time, because we were all on separate units. I was reaching out. I wanted people to hear our story. We were writing to the Innocence Project. We were writing to ACLU, to Lambda, to anybody that would just hear us out. And unfortunately, we always got a negative response stating that they could not take our case because, you know, they didn't have the funding, or there was no DNA involved. We had no new evidence. There was always an excuse. So we were always getting knocked down. But we never gave up. And eventually there was a gentleman by the name of Daryl Otto out of Canada who was writing Elizabeth. And she told him, you know, we're innocent. And of course, his thinking is, yeah, right, everybody in prison says we're innocent. But she was like, no, we are. And she gave him the information that he needed to research our case, and he believed in us. And he said he was not going to stop fighting for us until something happened. So with that, he went to the National Center for Reason and Justice, where he brought us to their attention, and they believed in us. So they sent our case to the Innocence Project of Texas, where they found Michael Ware. And Michael Ware is an amazing attorney who opened our case back up, and he researched it, and he said he believed in us, and he fought and fought, and we were released in 2013.
What did it feel like when someone finally said, I believe in you?
It felt so good. Now, it was kind of unreal because, you know, after being locked up so long, you kind of become that place. Not necessarily in a bad way, but you're just, you're there and you have to survive, you have to be okay with it.
Right.
And it was really, really hard. So when people would tell us, oh, well, guess what? You know, this person, you know, is looking into your case or whatever, you know, it would be like, okay, that's good. You know, but we never believed anything until we saw it. So when Michael Ware came to visit us, that was when I was like, wow, there's hope. You know, this man came to see us. He believes in us and he's going to start fighting for us.
Hope is amazing and scary at the same time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is because it's one of those things where you can hold on to it and be rejected or denied. And then there's one of those things where you can hold on to it and it goes well. I mean, we suffered a little bit of both of them.
So his avenue to get you back into court or through the courts, was it?
I think that his strategy was based on the fact that, well, I'm not sure if you know, but we had a recantation. But before that, yes, it was basically the fact that, you know, we had no medical, how do you say it? We had no, he actually had an expert witness go over the medical exam part of our trial and realized that that was completely false. What she testified was not real. So with that being said, they managed to get some other things going, which, let me see, it was the medical evidence, the recantation, and God, what else was it?
The recantation was by one of the girls, is that?
Yes. Her name was Stephanie. She came forward and told the truth that nothing had ever happened because she was not aware that what she had done as a child had been so traumatic on us. You know, she was just a child. She had no idea what she had done. So therefore, when she found out, she was very, very sorry. She came forward to Mike Ware and to, you know, some other people, and it ended up getting us released. We were released on a bond in 2013. That's how the Innocence Project had us removed. That's how Michael Ware got us out on a bond. So when we were released, we had to wait for a hearing. So here we were going back to court again all these years later. When we went to court, it was with Pat Priest, who was the same judge who had actually convicted us, or we were convicted in his courtroom. And which doesn't make a lot of sense because you know that there's going to be some type of feelings. I mean, we were actually convicted in his courtroom at one time. So to try to go back and, you know, say, hey, look, this wasn't right, we got to make it right, didn't really work out that way. So when we had the hearing, he didn't agree with the fact that he felt we deserved, you know, exoneration or, you know, a new trial. He didn't feel like any of that should have been done. But by the grace of God, we were sent to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and that's where they decided to give us our exoneration.
That's amazing. Can you tell me about the day you were released?
So in 2013, that was like a dream come true, something that we had long awaited for and something that I would dream about constantly. I always wondered what it was going to be like the day that I walked out of those gates and was able to just hug my family again. It was, I remember we were sitting in our pods because we were extradited from our units in Gatesville and in Marlin, and when we came down, we had to be in county for at least a week before we were actually released. And that day we had a court hearing where the judge had to approve our bond. And when she did, we were waiting in our pods to go home. And there was so many reporters and there was so many family members and just people out there that loved us, just waiting for us to be able to come out. And when we did, it was like, I can't even describe it. All I know is it was a great feeling to be able to hug my kids and my brother and my mom and everybody, you know, not behind a glass or being watched by anyone or told what to do or to stop hugging them or
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
How was it like to get used to not living in prison anymore? What was like your reacclimation into society like?
I started working 2 weeks after I was released. I've always been that type of person. I've always had a job. I've always, you know, tried to do what I had to. 2 weeks after I came home, I went and started applying to places, and I was given my first job. And I just had to get right back into it. Technology was hard to get used to. I'm so used to all the old school ways from back in 1994.
Right.
So it was in 1998, 2000, but I just had to start all over again. I mean, really, my family made me so comfortable, and they helped me in so many ways to where it wasn't so hard, you know. And I mean, I just continued with my life. I just tried to put that behind me to where I could move on and learn and do what I had to do.
And how was the relationship with your children? I mean, was it what you thought it would be when you were released?
I think that being a mother, you want to come home and believe that everything is going to be perfect. You have these children and it's just going to be like, hey, you know, here I am, you know, but, you know, I spent 14 years away from them. So wanting to hold them and hug them and just love on them. And I mean, my daughter, when I left, she was only 8. And so she didn't know me very well, you know, and it was very hard to, I just wanted to hug her and hold her, but I have to remember that I have to, you know, you have to take things a little bit slower and get comfortable with her again. And, you know, just make sure that you're not overstepping boundaries, because they're already obviously very grown. Yeah. Cause when I came out, they were in their 20s, and it was, over time, my son and my daughter and I, we've established a very, very strong relationship. You know, we have a lot of love for each other. And I mean, we're closer than close right now. And I just love that they call me if they need anything, or, you know, we spend time. I was with my daughter last night, you know, and my son lives in Austin right now, but, you know, we stay very, very close.
That's amazing. And so how would you say your life is going now?
How is my life going now? My life is beautiful right now. It really, really is. I mean, for me to sit here and look back at what I just went through just a couple of years ago, where I was like in such a dark, dark place, and see that now I have my family. I'm able to do things for my children, with my children, with my family. It's amazing to see the difference. I'm starting my enrollment process to St. Mary's so that I can become a paralegal, because I want to help the Innocence Project.
Congratulations.
We've been traveling the world, letting people know about what happened to us, so that it won't happen to anybody else. Or we want to help others. We want an advocate to keep, you know, people out of prison that don't belong there. We speak at universities. We talk to lawyers. We talk to anybody and anyone who listen, because I feel like people in this world need to be educated on, you know, what could happen, because one day your life can be perfect and the next you don't know what may hit you. And us being as naive as we were, if we would have known things differently, we probably would have taken a different approach, you know, to what we went through.
Right.
But yeah, so we just want to help people as much as we possibly can.
Can I tell you that you're doing it? And even when I was standing at my little table at the Innocence Conference, I had no idea who you were until you came up to my table. And even just like looking at you, I could tell that you were a person who looked content, who looked like you know that you can help people, like you know that you have something special. And I think that that's amazing. And I'm glad that you're using it to help people.
Thank you so, so much. That means a lot to us, because, I mean, I think that we suffered so much. We don't want other people to suffer this way, you know, and it's amazing that we never knew that stuff like this happened until it actually happened to us. Yeah, so we want to do as much as we possibly can.
What advice would you give to someone who finds themselves being wrongly accused or wrongly convicted even of something they didn't do?
okay, first of all, don't give up. Never give up. And always fight. Because there were moments when I wanted to give up. You know, there were moments when I thought that I was never going to see the light. I was never going to have what we have today. And but instead, I picked myself up. I started writing to people. We started, you know, making ourselves more known. I mean, because you have to understand, like, with us, a crime that we were accused of, us telling our story is very, it was very hard. Because, like I said, nobody wants to listen to anybody who's been accused of molesting kids. But we knew we had done nothing wrong, and we wanted people to hear our story. And we put ourselves out there hoping that something would happen, and eventually it did. You can't give up. And you have to, and that's why, like, right now, one thing that we always say is it happened to us, it could happen to anyone. You know, you have to be aware of your rights. You have to be aware of what steps to take in case something like this happens to you. Because so many people think that the cops know what they're doing. You know, they're there to help you, but really you can only help yourself.
Last question. And I get this question like every day, more than once.
Okay.
What can the average person like me and my listeners who aren't attorneys do to help people who've been wrongly convicted?
Okay, so this is the thing. I know as myself, if I was a person on the outside, you know, wondering what can I do before this even got, you know, we used to watch documentaries back in the day when the West Memphis 3 came out, you know, and we saw what they were going through and that they were supposedly innocent or just other things that were happening to people, like with the Salem witch hunts and stuff like that. And obviously you need good representation. Now, my thing is we are donating to the Innocence Project for what they did for us because we want them to continue to fight for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I'm getting my education. But if you're just somebody that wants to just help or make a difference, the smallest thing means so much. I mean, because this world is full of so many different people, so many people. And if each one of them just donated a little bit, do you know what that would do for people? You know, just adding it all up.
Right.
Just so that they can fight these cases. Because in such a short time, Michael Ware did so much for us that our attorneys didn't do because they felt that we were just a couple of, you know, Latina lesbians that didn't have the money. So they didn't feel like, you know, they needed to do anything. But with them, they stepped in. They gave us polygraphs. They did exams on us, you know, everything that they needed to prove our innocence. And all that stuff takes money. But they did it. You know, they went out, you know, God, they went out on a limb for us. And it's amazing that they did it. And like I said, all that stuff does take money. So I would say, you know, to everybody, please, it doesn't even have to be a lot. You know, if you $5 here, maybe $10, you know, just a little bit a month or whatever you can afford, you know, like if you're an attorney and you do paralegal services or whatever you do, if you can donate some of your time. You know, you never know what type of difference you can make in this world. You can bring somebody home, you know, to a family that is waiting for them, just like mine was.
You said that you guys go on, like, speaking.
Uh-huh.
Do you have, like, a public social media that you share or that people could...
They could go to?
Yeah.
The only site that we have is our Facebook site. It's from our movie.
Okay.
Our documentary, which is called Southwest of Salem, that is on Facebook.
Okay. I'll put a link to it in the notes underneath the show so people can click on it if they'd like to see it.
Yes, please. And they'll see if we're speaking anywhere. Usually that is updated with wherever we'll be or whatever we're doing.
Until next time, I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. A special thanks to our sponsor, Smile Direct Club. Remember, if you can't financially support our sponsors, you can still help them by giving them a shout out on social media. Visit our website, actualinpod.com, for more information and check out our new podcast, Convicted, on your favorite podcast app. Our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks again, and always, for listening. Before you go, I want to tell you about another podcast that tells the story of people who have been wrongfully convicted. It's called Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Here's a little preview.
With the police banging on the door, open up.
The choice to be in that lineup was the last choice I made as a free man.
A year later, I ended up right in the system.
I'm going to be one of those people who everyone in the world is going to think is a monster or suspect is a monster for the rest of my life, and I'm just going to have to come to peace with that.
Somebody was able to look at my picture in a database and say that I was somewhere where I definitely wasn't.
I overheard three of the jailers discussing what part they might have to play in my hanging. They had been told that two prison officers would have to participate in my execution.
And I walked back inside that prison for the last time, man. All hell broke loose, man.